Hello and welcome to the Euromoney Conference's online podcast for Friday, the 28th of March, 2014. This is episode 6, and today we're going to look at a slightly wider geographical area than we normally do. And we're talking to my friend and colleague, Christoph Schosky, who's just back from places in Russia that I have never heard of, but he has. We'll talk to Chris in a minute, but before that, the inevitable and obligatory commercial. On the Euromoney Conference's online site this week, we have a very special series of new videos, which are three leading hedge fund managers giving what they think are their best investment ideas at the moment. You have to register. It's important that we know who you are for this. It's for qualified investors only. So please go to euromoneyconferencesonline.com and register. Registration is free, and it takes only about 30 seconds. And then you can watch these new videos that were posted from our Absolute Return Symposium at the tail end of last week. You can, as always, follow us on Twitter at EuromoneyConf. You can visit us at EuromoneyConferencesOnline.com. And if you're into LinkedIn, search for Euromoney Conferences Online and you'll find our LinkedIn group there. So let me introduce to you Chris Ostrowski. Chris runs our Russian regions business. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Richard.
Just fill us in and tell us where you have recently been. I know that you were in Russia in a number of different places during the time when the Crimea crisis was at its peak. So why don't you fill us in where you were and what you were doing there?
So I started just at the very beginning of this month with a trip to Krasnoyarsk, which is seen as the capital of Siberia. And it was one of the big international forums that the Russian government put on. And I was a panelist there and spoke at a number of panels and met with a number of international and Russian business people. And at that time, the Crimea crisis still looked like it was quite contained. But from there, we flew to the far east of Russia, to Kamchatka, to the peninsula that just is closer to Alaska than anywhere else. And the time we spent there saw the events in Moscow and Crimea worsen. But we still had, I think, a very good and interesting meeting there. And from there, we went on to the island of Sakhalin, which almost touches Japan. So two Far Eastern venues and one destination in Siberia, I think, gave me quite a lot to do during that time.
So when you're in Kamchatka, are those the Russians that Sarah Palin thinks she can see from Alaska?
They're the ones. So that's where she sees Putin raising his head over the parapet to say hello to the people of Anchorage.
Yeah, it's a wonderful image, Sarah Palin and Vladimir Putin. Anyway, let's start in the far east. What took you out there? Why was a Euromoney person in what might be described as the middle of bloody nowhere?
It really is the middle of nowhere. I was there because I had met the governor of Kamchatka in Sochi in September. I launched these regional investment forums in 2013 with an event in Bashkortostan. And we've quickly come to see that many of these regional governors are very ambitious and progressive, and they really want the best for their regions. And with Moscow becoming a little bit less internationalist, partly for political reasons and for a variety of other complex reasons, some of these regional governors want to have an international event which doesn't depend on them channeling their energy through Moscow. The big investment forums that the government run, like SPIEF in St. Petersburg and Sochi that I just referred to, and Krasnoyarsk that I was attending earlier this month, only sort of serve a certain purpose with the federal government's agenda. What these regional governors and these regional presidents of the autonomous republics are looking for is an international forum where we can bring international financiers, some investors, some counterparties to really meet with the local corporates so they can find the best way of using international finance to meet their development needs and to meet the needs of the and the needs and the ambitions of the local politicians.
So, I mean, you have your forum in Bashkortostan, the second one that's coming up in just over a week's time. Will any foreigners go to that?
Yes, there will. We've got 20 people who are literally getting on a plane and attending that. Most of them will be going to Ufa, which is the capital of Bashkortostan, for the first time. But on top of that, we've actually got 53 foreign companies represented, some of them by foreign workers based in Moscow or elsewhere in Russia. And again, these companies are companies that are coming to Ufa and to Bashkortostan to assess the investment and the financing opportunities, which is quite difficult for the government to do on its own. So it's always the challenge getting international participants to go to these more remote places. But the team that we've got in Euromoney and the heritage we've got, we did an event in Kazan for 3 years, which finished in 2010, means that we are able to get people to attend these events and to engage with the projects that we're doing in a way that's quite effective.
Has what's happened in Crimea and Ukraine affected the number of people that you think you are going to get in Ufa? I mean, would you have had more had Mr. Putin not decided to, reclaim what he believes to be rightfully his?
It's very difficult to tell. We haven't had anybody drop out, but we would always like to drive up the numbers of international participants. It might well have had an effect, which is difficult for us to assess. I think the numbers may be slightly higher if it hadn't been for the Crimea crisis, but it hasn't had what I would describe as a material impact on what we're trying to do. We were in regular contact with all our clients, all these federal governors, including President Hamitov, who is the president of Bashkortostan. We reassured him about our efforts when this kicked off, and he was, willing to be reassured. He was pleased to hear what we had to say. Similarly, when we were in Kamchatka, there's obviously a period of jumpiness when a crisis unravels when you're actually in the country itself. But these manifest themselves in things like meetings being cancelled at short notice. But the actual project, which, as I said, we started to launch in September when I first met the governor of Kamchatka, still continues. So Bashkortostan is looking good. We've got a good audience. We've got international participants. We've got people from the British Russian Chamber of Commerce, people from Bashneft speaking, and it's looking like a very successful event.
But how did, you just said you've been in communication with senior political leaders in the Russian regions over the last 2 or 3 weeks. What do you feel is their reaction to what's happened in Crimea? I mean, are they very pro this action? Are they against it? Or is it something that they just feel doesn't really have much relevance to them?
I think it does have relevance. Even in Kamchatka, which is miles and miles away from Crimea, the local governor had to deal with a pro-Crimea rally in Petropavlovsk, which is tens of thousands of miles away from Crimea. So it certainly does matter. And the view...
When you say a pro-Crimea rally, you presumably mean people who were pro the Russian actions in Crimea.
Exactly. People who were pro-Crimea becoming part of Russian territory. Mm. So it certainly matters. And I think certainly in the short term and amongst some of the what I would call the government functionaries, there's a growth in support for Putin and a very sort of pro-nationalist view of the actions that have been taken. The thing to remember about Russia, though, is it has a very internationalized elite. It has a very internationalized elite both in its business and banking sector and also in certain parts of the government. So some of these regions, particularly Sakhalin, have very internationalized people who've lived in different countries and speak different languages, who are in senior regional government positions, in some of the regions, more so than others. And this is where sanctions will matter the most. And this is where I think I do see some of the fear and concern. Sanctions against Iran or North Korea have less of an impact because there isn't such an internationalized elite. But these individuals do understand the importance of the Asian axis, particularly in Siberia and the Far East. And they also understand the impact that it will have on their lives personally if sanctions go to the next level. So there is a concern about what will develop, but in general, there is also, I would say, short-term support for Putin's actions.
Mm. And you felt that that was, even on the other side of the world, being in Sakhalin and Kamchatka, that that was still a matter of concern. Maybe concern is too strong a word, but something that they felt was definitely on their radar screen that hadn't been there a few months before.
They can certainly see that the challenge of organising an investment forum is greater when these sanctions are in place and when there is a standoff between the US and Russia, or the European Union and Russia. So it was certainly a concern to them how this would end. The end game is of concern to the people we were speaking to in government positions.
Mm. And your personal opinion on that? I mean, do you think it is going to affect the way that capital flows into the Russian regions?
Into the Russian regions, it's difficult to say at the moment, particularly the Russian regions in the Far East, because one of the things they really want us to do is to open up the market to Japanese, Korean, Chinese, and the sort of Pacific Rim. So yeah. How this is being played out in Asia is of great importance to those particular forums in the Far East. In somewhere like Bashkortostan, I think it does have the potential to cause a decline in investments. It really depends what happens next. If Putin is doing this from a position of weakness, where if he thinks that he has to annex Crimea because he thought he was about to lose Sevastopol to an antagonistic Ukrainian regime, then he might be in a position where there will be a further escalation, a further confrontation, which will result in further sanctions. I personally think further sanctions are actually quite likely. I think the second stage is quite likely. So far, we've seen 12 fairly junior people. We haven't seen anyone from the banking sector, with one exception. We haven't really seen anyone from the banking sector be included in this. If it goes to the next stage and starts to include the financial sector, then the sanctions will I think have an impact on what we're trying to do. So it's still quite delicate, but as we saw for Bashkortostan, when we were in the process of building the audience, of developing the agenda, of inviting speakers, we've still managed to produce what looks to be quite an effective forum in the midst of all this.
I heard somewhere this week that some of the Russians were saying that the sanctions were a badge of honour, and that they rather liked the idea that they had sanctions, and that other people were asking if they could have sanctions too, because that clearly meant they were very important and very close to Mr. Putin. Is that slightly facetious?
Well, obviously, I think it's slightly facetious. And I also think that there is a divide as well. I think Putin's circle of advisors is less... I spoke about Moscow becoming less internationalized, and also see Vladimir Putin and his circle of advisors becoming less global and less international in their outlook. So the people who are surrounding him are now more nationalistic, and they're not necessarily the people who are buying houses in Kensington and driving Mercedes. But those people, those oligarchs, those mini-garchs, are the people who ultimately will decide the future direction of the Russian leadership. So though the functionaries who have had the CEO of Russian Railways, for example, is a good example, I think the oligarchs and the mini-garchs who ultimately have a lot of say on the Russian leadership will become unhappy if sanctions do increase further. For the government functionaries and the pure Putin loyalists, it's fine, but there are obviously an important sector of the Russian society who will be hurt by these sanctions, and Putin cannot afford to upset them.
And where do you see it? I mean, you know, we looked at a number of different scenarios, but it seems to be at the moment in an equilibrium within the disequilibrium, let's say. What would be something that would kick this crisis back up to the top of the front pages again? Where should we be looking? I mean, let's start with Ukraine and then go to wider Russia, but should we be looking at eastern Ukraine, at what happens there? Is that the next flashpoint?
Certainly. I think Putin's age-old tactic of doing something ghastly in the eyes of the international community and then threatening to do something even more ghastly to bring the Western powers to the negotiating table might well be what he is doing here. So the threat to invade eastern Ukraine or to cause unrest inside Ukraine is something which would certainly push this to a level where it would be difficult for foreign companies to operate. I personally don't think that that is what's happening. I think Putin is trying his age-old tactic of simply threatening to do something even more horrendous to cut a deal on the first thing that he did, which was annex the Crimea. So I don't think that will happen. But there needs to be, I think, a real and a certain degree of vigilance in the eastern cities in Donetsk and in the border areas which surround Russia. The most interesting thing, though, is that Putin, I think, really has lost Ukraine. I mean, all the opinion polls now point towards a far, far stronger will of the people to move towards the European Union, even join NATO, which was never popular in Ukraine up until this crisis. So Putin losing friends in the Ukraine, with the exception of Crimea, has, I think, possibly weakened his hand to actually do anything if he was ever going to anyway.
Mm. Yeah, I think we will have to remember that the Crimea takeover was a reaction to the loss of Yanukovych and the broadly pro-Russian regime in the whole of Ukraine. So,
yes, I think so. Though I do worry that not everybody has seen it that way in the West. I think the speed of analysis with which people came to the conclusion that Putin was trying to destabilize the Ukraine and grab Crimea for his own benefit as a sort of chest beating pro-Russian, pro-Putin exercise does alarm me a little bit. I think he might genuinely have been afraid of losing his Black Sea fleet to a hostile regime. And I'm not sure if the American government has quite picked up on that as a possible analysis, which does concern me somewhat.
Mm. And who do you see in the international? I mean, you're not plugged into. Maybe you are into the diplomatic community, but there seems to be a little bit of a, US going one way and the Europeans going the other on this. Do you think that those two Western groupings have coordinated themselves a little better now?
They have certainly coordinated themselves a bit better. I think Barack Obama was getting a bit scared of saber rattlers in Congress and has strengthened his position and has, in doing so, has brought the European Union to a position where they're stronger on a second wave of sanctions as well. It is always easier for the US from a distant part of the globe, with the exception of Alaska and Kamchatka at least, to demand sanctions. German companies, Polish companies, companies in even companies in Southeast Europe, such as Greece and Croatia, have a far, far closer and far more important link to the Russian economy, not just in energy but in other things as well. I mean, even the German Mittelstand use Russia as a production base in some sectors. So sanctions affect the economy and the people of Central European countries in a far more obvious way than they do in the US. So it's easy to call for sanctions when you're very distant. So I think there is a coming together of the two parties in this. For the record, I do think that what we would like to see, or what would be good, would be for Ukraine really to have the option to choose its own destiny, whether that's Europe or Russia. I personally don't mind which, but if you compare it to Poland, the GDP per capita was almost identical when the Soviet Union fell. The GDP per capita in Poland is now $13,000 or $14,000, and it's still $3,000 for the Ukraine. If it had decided to go fully with Russia, it would be better off. If it had decided to go fully with Europe, it would be better off. But leaving it in no man's land in between has caused it to be the poorest country, or one of the poorest countries in Europe, and that can't continue.
That's a very interesting piece of analysis. The final question on this in terms of end games, slightly reading in between the lines, it appears to me that the Western powers genuinely think that giving Crimea to, or letting Russia keep Crimea, have Crimea, is, there's a certain amount of reason behind it, and it's sort of all right, and no one wants to spark a major Cold War or whatever between between the regions, but it's this far and no further. Is that
is a reasonable analysis. I really see this as a missed opportunity because Ukrainians themselves never saw Crimea as an ordinary part of the Ukraine. The international community never really saw Crimea as any part of the Ukraine. I mean, if you ask a man on the street in London, if you know where is Crimea, most people would probably say it's in Russia, because this is in the Crimea War. In our mindset, in our thinking, Crimea is part of Russia. The missed opportunity was that Putin really could have done this in a way that was far more effective and far more would have given him far more credence in the international community, and possibly with his oligarchs. He could have played a Western game and had a referendum 3 months hence, like they did in Kosovo, and had an outcome which the international community said, oh, so Russia is serious, Russia is back. The Russians some Russians might think the West is always out to trap them. But I don't really think that this final solution of Crimea being part under Russian control was something that's ghastly in the eyes of the international community.
No, I mean, it was de facto there because of the Black Sea Fleet's been there, and it's, you know, Russia has always had a very large military presence in Crimea, and, you know, okay, at the moment, allegedly, and it is allegedly because, of course, there weren't that many Russian troops there. They were, public-spirited Crimean citizens who just wanted to help. It still doesn't have a large military presence there. So, you know, it's something that not much has really changed except for the flag.
Exactly. I think this far and no further is the right way of putting it. I think seeing the Russian flag flying over the Crimea military bases and the ships in Sevastopol and so on is not something that's totally ghastly in the minds of the international community. But if there is a step further, then I think there will be a swift escalation, and that will be a cause for concern for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, seeing the Russian flag fly over some of the cities in eastern Ukraine would, I think, be something completely different. Excellent. So, Chris, thank you very much for joining us. I know it's been a little difficult to get our schedules to work together. And any of you listening want to go to the wonderful Euromoney Bashkortostan conference? It's on the 8th of April, Chris, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Which is, you better get your skates on if you're going to go to that. We'll also be having a follow-up to that. We'll let you all know how that went and what came out of it. And I hope that we'll have Chris back on future podcasts. So thanks very much, Chris.
Thanks, Richard.
And that really brings us to the end for this week. Next week, we're going to talk about Turkey, and particularly about the outcome and meaning of the Turkish local and regional elections, which will take place on Sunday, the 30th of March, and are being closely watched as an indicator of the future of both of the AKP and of Mr. Erdogan himself. And we will come to you next week with some analysis and comment on that in advance of our Eurasia Forum, which will take place in Istanbul on the 3rd of June. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to speaking to you all next week.